Welcome everybody to concurrent session 2B, I think we are, Virtue, Hubris and Risk Culture. If that's not the session that you thought you were coming to, I can't help you as to where your correct session is, but feel free to leave now. If you should be here and are not, well, you obviously can't hear me tell you that we're about to start. Obviously, the first session in some places ran a little over time. We had to wait for one of our presenters. We have two presenters for this paper today. Before I introduce them to you, I am obliged to do some housekeeping, which I nearly forgot to do. I need to tell you that the session is being recorded. There are people following this session on a webinar, and for them as well as posterity, any comments that you make from the floor, please do so at the microphone in the centre of the room, and please give your name. The organisers have also asked me to remind you to tweet as much as you can. That will have no effect on this session, but it will affect, apparently, your ability to win the tweeting prize. please give feedback using the FSF Connect app. They could have come up with a better name. At the end of the session. There will be a bell 5 minutes before we finish, as you all experienced and know that sort of thing. We will try and run to shorter than that, but Anthony and Tracy have said that they would welcome questions and comments on the way through. Again, if you feel stirred to give an instant feedback, please get up and talk at the microphone. But again, before I introduce our presenters, I would just like, just so that we get a sense of this session, who's actually read the paper? Just me. Okay. That's fine. You know what you're working with. Okay. Anthony, I was told you were starting, but it looks as though you're not. So Trace is going to start. Tracy is a lecturer at the Australian School of Business, which is part of Uni of New South Wales, or connected to, where she teaches leadership, people management and business ethics. And she also has an adjunct position with the university's Centre for Social Impact, where she's constantly inspired by her students who are already changing the world for the better. Anthony is a South African Australian with a career spanning traditional actuarial work in life and superannuation, teaching and regulation. And he's now an associate professor at the University of New South Wales, so we get the link between the two. Anthony is convener of the Institute's Retirement Income Working Group, which incorporates a lot of his research interests and other interests he's followed through the years. He also talks about here, but I want to get to listen to them, so we won't go through that. But we will say that he lives in Sydney, where he particularly enjoys bridge, bushwalking and books, and if he could come up with anything else beginning with B, he'd probably enjoy that too.
Okay. Tracy. All right, well, thanks, everyone. And I'm really delighted to be here. I'm not an actuary. I was a chemist in my first life and then later on became an organisational behaviour and sociology person with an interest in ethics. So it's lovely to be in this particular audience. Anthony and I came together to do this paper because we both share an interest in ethics and in a particular kind of ethics, which is what we call virtue ethics. So we're here today to talk a little bit about how we think that might apply to some of the issues that are faced in terms of risk cultures. So it's always good to start with a few scandals, and I learnt that tonight on Four Corners they're actually running a episode on the Commonwealth CBA scandal of a couple of years ago, so it's good timing for us. because I guess most of you know that these big failures, once the Royal Commissions or the investigations come through, there's always somewhere talking about culture, leadership and management. And it seems to be that the more we see of these failures, we're getting the same record, the same song over and over again. So we just got to sort of go into that and to use the lens of ethics and in particular to use the lens of virtue ethics. So scandals, all of the sorts of scandals that we have been seeing, and we can talk about HIH, we can talk about National Australia Bank, we can talk about CBA as we will be tonight, they can be thought of as failures of integrity, failures of justice, if you like, and failures of obviously due diligence and of prudence. And in each of these stories, you can see the same theme. You know, it's almost like a musical theme coming through. And the other thing that we're seeing in the investigations into these failures are issues of hubris and overconfidence on the part of particularly the leaders at various levels. So we want to bring virtue ethics lens onto that because we think that it offers a better way of dealing with the sorts of problems with risk cultures that perhaps a rule-based system of ethics or a system of ethics based on utilitarian calculations, for example, it gives us a better understanding of what to do about it. Because when we understand virtue ethics, we can get to the heart of the problem and to the need to create virtuous circles, feedback loops, rather than the vicious circles and feedback loops that we see. So that's why we've kind of used this today. But I just want to start by looking at some of the reasons why organisations do bad things and end up harming people. And they do stem back to culture. So John Daly's done some research looking at how organisations create cultures where people are harmed. And obviously in CBA tonight, there is real harm done to people, as with the other corporate scandals like HIH or the NAB trading scandals. So, I mean, in financial services industry, you know that there is often a diffusion of responsibility and a diffusion of information. So information becomes fragmented and people know part of the story but not the whole story. But also they don't feel responsible for the overall consequences of the actions that they take. And the other reason that organisations can cause harm is that harm can be abstract. So something like a sales or a revenue goal is very concrete and tangible, and you need to be accountable for it in the next quarter or the next year. Whereas the impact on someone's superannuation is a little bit more diffuse. It's a little bit more abstract. And what this means is that people focus on the here and now. And quite often there's a culture that rewards and encourages the focusing on the here and now. And I guess the other reason is that ethical issues are complex and they are part of complex systems, and so the actual consequences emerge over time. When things go wrong, it's always sometime after the fact of the first decision to do the rogue trading or the first decision to try and act in an unethical way. And the last thing also relates to culture, and that's corporate socialisation. This idea that everybody else does it, so why don't we? And that was definitely the defence that was mounted in the NAB case, for example. And so really we come back to the culture, and the risk culture is part of an overall organisation's culture. And it's also part of an overall risk system. So culture, as any of you who were in Sean and Andrew's presentation just now will know, that operates at different levels. But you can see culture in the way people do things, the norms of behaviour. You can see it in the values, and that's things like what's important around here, what gets priority around here, or what gets rewarded around here, what sorts of behaviours get rewarded around here. They're all signs of the culture. The other thing that you can see culture in is the frames of thinking, the sort of lenses that people view the world. And often that's taken for granted and doesn't get questioned. So this idea of the short-term bottom line, for example, is one example of a frame of thinking that quite often doesn't get questioned at all. And you probably have your own examples of things that get taken for granted and not questioned in the financial services sector. But risk culture is not something that can be easily changed, because it's part of an overall risk system, and in the risk system are the firms themselves, but there's also regulators, there's also other stakeholders, there's governments. So we need to understand that it's really part of what is called a complex adaptive system. And I don't know if many of you are familiar with the old work of the biologists in this, but most human systems, when we think about it, particularly those connected to the business world and to the global economy, and I've got a quote there by Peter Senge, who was a management guru back in the day when I was first learning all about this as a manager. But what that means is that often there's no linear cause-effect relationship between what we do and what happens. You get complex feedback loops, and often when you make a decision, the effect of it is sometime later in time or in another place. And you get positive and negative feedback loops too. So sometimes a decision can create a positive cycle of events or a negative cycle of events. And I was just thinking on my way in here, the idea of alcohol-related violence is an example of a complex system that needs to be understood in order to actually make positive changes. And probably having zoned lockouts in the city, you're all familiar with the debate on that, what that means is that's a simple lever. There are other parts of the city where the young people that want to get drunk and be violent will go. And you'll have, so instead of actually fixing the problem, you're getting these unintended negative feedback loops. So what we'll see is we'll just see the violence move to another part, but because policing has been reduced. So you get the idea of the complex system and how things really need to be thought of in their complexity. So what that means, and I'm going to be handing over to Anthony in a moment, but what that means is that good governance has to require an understanding of the system, not just in terms of systems thinking, but also in what we want to talk about a bit more today, and that's the idea of virtuous character, to overcome those system interests that our colleague Giulio Cipelli from Italy talks about. So before I hand over to Anthony, I'll just talk briefly about how dominant personalities, and if we think about an example like HIH, Ray Williams would be the classic example of a leader. There's a lovely quote that the whole HIH scandal was the unwary following the inept further and further into their destruction. So, but with a culture like that, it becomes toxic, so that the norms and the values and the taken for granted ways of seeing the world help to perpetuate a system where you have these negative feedback loops and vicious circles. And in this case, Ray Williams' leadership was characterised by his hubris and his overconfidence. And the whole of the HIH Owen report, those of you that have read it, and it's over 10 years old now, but it's a great read if you haven't looked at it. But basically, the board did not question the management. They didn't question any of the decisions that were made, and they weren't able to even think in sort of basic strategic ways, according to Justice Owen. So there were all these sorts of negative behaviours around the dominant personality of this particular person. And so I will hand over to Anthony in a moment, who's going to talk about what we might do about it. Because I guess one thing that can be said is that with dominant personalities, you can try and counter that by having lots of other dominant personalities, but that's not necessarily going to solve the problem. We want to take you to another plane and to talk about, well, the best way to solve the problem is to think about both the culture and the individuals within the board and in other leadership positions, to think about the idea of having virtue at the bedrock of that kind of culture. Because really, if we try to deal with these complex adaptive systems in simple mechanistic ways, we won't get to the heart of the problem. And I think some of the regulatory approaches that have been taken are very simple and mechanistic ways of trying to deal with what's a complex adaptive system. So I'll hand over to you, Anthony.
Thanks. One of the lovely things about being at universities, you can find people that actually know more. If you've got a gap in your knowledge, you can find someone who knows a lot more. In fact, done a PhD in it, and what was delightful is to find Tracy and I agree on a whole lot of stuff. So just look at this question of dominant personalities. Now, sorry, if you don't know what hubris means, it's the Greek word for pride, and one of the dominant themes in Greek drama and in Greek philosophy is in a sense, you know, who the gods wish to destroy, they first make crazy, but they actually put hubris in them. So hubris is pride comes before a fall. And what, certainly within the classical worldview, hubris was one of the worst things you could possibly have. Now, it seems to us, I think, that in modern management theory, hubris is regarded as a good thing. It's good to have dominant personalities. Now, it was interesting that the dominant personalities have been identified as one of the risk problems, and the one of the documents we quote in our paper is from the G20 body that looks at this and says that dominant personalities are a problem. But actually, if I just go up, I can. The International Actuarial Association responded to that paper, and they basically said, the only thing that can offset a strong personality is another strong personality. Now, I don't quite agree with that, but I thought at least their criticism of the risk framework was correct. What I want to take is firstly is just two elements that I think, or we think, aggravate this question of hubris in managerial practice in the modern world. And the first is remuneration. Now, there's a lot of talk in risk management about making sure that management remuneration does not encourage risk. And clearly, while managers are remunerated by share options that go up in value when risk increases, it's clearly bizarre. But this quote is from a paper in a recent book on ethics. And he looks at the issue, he takes the basic issue, management remuneration, the idea that you should align the interests of managers and shareholders, is basically the agency theory story. Unless you align the interests, managers will try and cheat. Now, frankly, that's an outrageously simplistic and insulting view of human nature. Do you do your job because you're paid to do it and for no other reason? No decent human being, frankly, would admit to that. What he says, that in a situation where you effectively are believing that people will not do their job unless they're paid for it, and will always, under game theory assumptions, cheat, defect, that the dominant assumption is that it's every man for himself, is it one that would not only encourage unethical behavior, but could become positively criminogenic. Don't think you'll find the criminogenic in the dictionary, but you know what it means. It actually encourages, pays for people to do criminal behavior. So my view and our view is that there's a serious problem with the size of management remuneration and the very view that people at the top of an organization will only do their job properly if they are bribed to do so. I've put a lot of quotes here because this is not just our view. It's widely spread within industry, but it's not often heard because it's very unpopular amongst some of the people that count. But nevertheless, I do believe it needs to be said and said more with more vigor and more frequently. So that's management remuneration. The other part, and this is earnings management. When I tell my students that they're going out and next year many of them are going to actually have to do valuations, I have to tell them that one of the things that's going to happen, one of them's in the room at the moment, one of the things that's going to happen is the CFO is going to come down, and after they've done the first calculation is going to tell them, can you please adjust this? It's giving the wrong message. Now, let me just ask you, how many of you would believe that that is common practice sorry, put it the other way around. How many believe that is not common practice in the Australian insurance industry? Okay. I thought that would be a bit like that. The fact of the matter is that it is common practice, and the research in the United States shows it's pretty much universal, certainly before Sarbanes-Oxley, and apparently it not changing much subsequently. One of the things we're doing is deceiving our shareholders. Now, I tell my students, you know, that's what you're going to be told to do. Remember it's wrong. No heroics. Do what you're told. But hopefully when you get to a point when you actually can make decisions, you won't do it. But, I mean, am I wrong? If we're deceiving our shareholders to whom we have a fiduciary duty, what are we doing to our customers? What are we doing to staff? The idea that the industry has become effectively criminogenic in many respects is a serious ethical problem. And if we see it as an ethical problem, it needs ethical responses, and that's why it's a different way of viewing risk management. So as far as APRA is concerned, it seems to me that if there's risk management, if you're not prepared to hear the bad news that should come from your earnings reports, you're not prepared to address the issues. And if you're not prepared to address the issues, you are a risk. The risks are there. So part of the story comes from this mechanistic. So how's the response? So if we look at ethics, one of the questions of ethics, and we'll come on to just, I have a couple of slides on this. One of the issues of ethics is you don't teach people good ethics by telling them what to do. You do tell a six-year-old not to tell lies, but you're not actually training them to want to tell the truth by stopping them telling lies. It's a sort of beginning. It's what you do for six-year-olds. You don't tell adults that the way to tell the truth, that they have to tell the truth in this way. So setting rules is not the way to create ethical change. Now, part of the problem is, if we look, sorry, not in great focus, I'll have to explain it, that ethics theory in the last century, as it tends to be in many centuries, has tended to be on the left-hand side here, which is effectively action ethics. So for those of you who've had a little bit of philosophy, and I've only got a little sort of smattering, enough to be dangerous, is that you get the deontological view, which comes mainly from Immanuel Kant in recent times, and they there talk about divine theory. Telling the truth is always right. You must always tell the truth under all circumstances. Now, it's quite easily shown that that can be quite dangerous if you're asked, well, sorry, the little story is about the Jesuits in the Middle Ages had the same story, but they became quite pragmatic when they were being pursued in England. And the story was you didn't have to tell the truth if there was a Jesuit priest hiding in your house and the government was after him to burn him at the stake. So one has to be pragmatic under certain circumstances. So the deontological rules can't always work. The other thing down here is consequentialism or utilitarianism, is that we determine what is right by whether the outcomes are right or not. But that doesn't really work because under those circumstances it would be a good idea that we could if five people want transplants of various parts of their body, we can actually kill a good, healthy person and divide them up. It doesn't quite work that way. Murdering is wrong. So those systems of ethical thinking don't really work. What is come back into fashion in a big way is Aristotle's old virtue of old theory of agents of what they call here agent ethics, of virtue theory. The good man is the person who aspires to be good, who wants to be just, honest, wise, caring, courageous, and those type of things. And it's a question of aspiration. So we need to aspire, and that's what creates motivation in our case. We want to aspire to be good. And any man, and this is I like this from David Carr, who's an educational theorist, no really rational being could understand fully what a quality like courage, temperance, justice, or compassion is, and yet fail to want to possess it. From this point of view, since the virtues are not innate, we don't automatically aspire to them, they entail both proper habit formation and the development of reason, it's clearly within the responsibility of all concerned, and that he talks about educators, and that would also mean leaders and organizations and regulators and all of us to continue to emphasize the virtues and how we actually to aspire to them. Now, we need, Tracy and I were saying, we need to talk a little bit about hypocrisy later, about what happens when you get too focused on virtue. But those are the questions that really need to be addressed if one's dealing with virtue. So here's a question. This slide actually I added on Friday because I produced it on Thursday as part of my quiz for next week. And Brendan, you just close your eyes on this score. The question is just matching on the left the various elements of some elements of risk management, and then on the right some of the traditional virtues that Aristotle and the Greek philosophers 2,500 years ago identified as the major virtues. So meeting obligations to all stakeholders is actually giving justice, because that's, as Aristotle defined it, is giving to everyone their due, profits to the shareholders, solvency to the creditors, reasonable expectations to the policyholders. Disclosing risks to stakeholders clearly is a matter of integrity. Being aware of unknowns is a matter of humility. Ensuring that no personalities come too dominant, I would suggest, is a matter of courage, which we need to develop. Actuaries without courage are no good at all. And most of us are not actually built to be particularly courageous, so we've got a real challenge on that score. Diligence is self-control, and sense of proportionality and prudence is judgment or prudence. So they actually map quite well to the virtues. Now, just this is really coming back to the idea that, in fact, by that giving detailed rules doesn't do the trick. It's a lovely paper, The Dog and the Frisbee, by Andrew Haldane, and I'm afraid I'm not sure what Medeiros' first name is. It's actually published in Nature, so it's got, that's the sort of top academic journal. And he's basically saying that dogs catch frisbees by watching them and just keep the angle right, and if they got the angle the same, they can catch the frisbee easily. And that simple models, heuristics, often perform better than complex models. And he shows that, in fact, the Basel I models would have worked better than the Basel II models in the GFC. And his argument, he's one of the senior guys at the Bank of England, is that, in fact, the risk models are far too complex. And we would do well to go back to simpler models, effectively principles rather than detailed prescription. It's a lovely paper. So before I hand back to Tracy for her wisdom in terms of changing behavior in organizations, which the management theorists have done, I want to make two points. The first is, I think the analysis of surplus that we have is a really good measure way of maintaining integrity. Because what a properly reported analysis of surplus identifies the assumptions, the extent to which the assumptions have been accurate in the past year, and the extent to which the assumptions have been changed. And if we keep management honest make sure that they and everyone know what are actually happening to those models of the future, how they work their way out in due course. So I actually think we can play a really, if we emphasize this analysis of surplus, which is to make sure that we face the bad news and we respond to it and we tell everyone what's happening and we let people know what the risks are, that we're performing the job that we do have as actuaries. And just before I hand over, the one point that I had wanted to say and is captured in our paper, which I just forgotten briefly, the other thing about ethics is to know that we make mistakes. So, I mean, we need a doctrine of sin. What John Braithwaite, who's a criminologist and a sociologist and a writer and regulator of the ANU, calls reintegrative shaming. And I think this is really very helpful. He says, if someone does something wrong, they need to be ashamed of what they've done. If we stigmatize them, you're a bad person, or if you report something that's wrong, we'll shoot the messenger, or if you report having made a mistake, you will be fired. We discourage the open reporting of mistakes and discussion of errors, and under some circumstances we create what he calls a counterculture. Well, there's a counterculture it's popular to say risks don't matter. Compliance is a disclosure. Yeah, risks don't matter. We don't. That's what APRA wants, but that's not what we do. That's not the way we do it here. So if we're going to produce a positive culture, we've got to have a way of, when people say I've done something wrong, of reintegrating them. So that's really what I had to say. Reducing dominance, I think. Back to you, Tracy. Yeah.
And that's a good segue in, I think, because this idea of being able to fail is part of the building in learning that experts on complex systems like Donella Meadows say is necessary if you want to actually try to change the system, change the risk culture system. So building in learning requires an understanding and being comfortable with failure. So that's one of the three ways that you really can do something about all this. First is to design learning in, and that it does include failure. And this is an example of one way that you can design learning in. And those of you who are in Andrew and Sean's presentation just now, they also talked about cycles of learning. But the idea of building in feedback loops where you make changes, so this idea of controlled experimentation in a small part of the firm, and you run a pilot, but then you learn from that pilot, you look at what sorts of things, you step back from the system and you look at what works, and then you try to then widen that out by disseminating the experiments. And this is how, and you do that through changing things like performance indicators, key performance indicator measurement dashboards, changing incentive systems, changing, but then learning from them. So there's no point in changing an incentive system to try and bring in a positive risk culture if that incentive system has some unintended consequences. So people like Donella Meadows say you must just step back from the system and try and get the beat of it to see what actually controls it and what those unintended negative feedback loops are. The other thing you can do is at the level of the board, and that's in terms of board renewal, this idea of carrying out ethical due diligence. So not just the ordinary due diligence that we're all familiar with, but when you're actually recruiting senior leaders and board members, ask them what ethics means. Ask them about their past, how they've dealt with ethical problems in the past. And that's a way of finding out the sorts of character that they are and the sorts of patterns of behaviour that they've developed. And the third way is, and this is something that's come from my research, is to try and create environments where it's safe to critically question the status quo, where it's okay to actually step back and to say this particular set of assumptions or norms is wrong. So because people will flourish if they have that ability to do that, and you can then actually get something countercultural happening, and then that kind of flourishing then moves on and on and on. So these are the sorts of things that can happen, and human nature, as Anthony said, we have the great capacity to do positive things, and most people want to do positive things. So it's about allowing those positive things to flourish, to allow failure to be okay, and to just conduct the kind of due diligence on ethics as you would on anything else. So that's pretty much wraps it up for us. Lots of other ideas.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you, Anthony. They will now take questions. So do I have a volunteer? Questions and comments, yes. If you violently agree or disagree, yes, please just come to the microphone.
Thanks, Tracy and Anthony. Very thought-provoking. Question on that last point, Tracy, you talked about creating an environment where it's safe for people to challenge the status quo. Anthony also talked about the challenge where you often have a senior executive who put pressure through an organisation for an expectation to manage market short-term needs. How do you balance that? How do you bring in or encourage a creation of a safe culture when you have those kind of tensions in the system?
I mean, I think the thing to acknowledge is that there is tensions, and that the human social world, which and the risk system is a social system ultimately, is is going to be living with paradox and tensions. But what I think is that saying it's okay to try something and then reflect on whether or not it worked, it's that being comfortable with failure that Anthony was talking about, and being comfortable with tensions to say, okay, there are these things that are working against us trying to do the right thing. We acknowledge them. We can't change everything, but we can be agents of change within our own small world. And I think that's the philosophy that we have, is that we all have the capacity to be agents of change in some world or other. None of us have the overall power over the system. Even the system itself doesn't have power over itself. So I don't know, does that answer your question?
Yep, partly. To me, there's two parts. There's a lot of people in organisations who are very socialised by the organisation.
Yes.
They don't necessarily have the capacity to stand up against the system.
Yes.
And to take the courageous stands you're asking for. And at the same time, you get people inside the organisation system who can. And I guess it's how do you...
It's both, yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, I think Anthony was saying it. You can't be the person from a junior level that takes on the CEO. That's not a reasonable thing. But what I found is that quite junior middle managers can get together, and what they can do is if they can talk to each other, they're not necessarily going to change the CEO. But if they feel it's okay to talk to each other at the same level wherever they are in the firm, then they can feel a sense of agency, even if they can't change the whole organisation's policies.
Thanks, Andrew. I like the idea of some ideas from just war theory, and which is a long history. And the thing is, you choose battles that you can win, that are really worthwhile fighting. But you have to, and you have to make sure that the collateral damage is quite small, and that you've particularly got to look to your own interests. But preparation is the key. So to be courageous, you've got to prepare yourself for a battle, and be creative in terms of how do you change the paradigm. Start raising the questions a year before you actually know the battle's going to be fought. Maybe under those circumstances, you can make a positive change.
And then you, Heather. Names, please.
Sorry. Emily Gaylor from Suncourt Life. I think when you mentioned earlier, all of us have kind of been in situations where CFOs or someone's come down and said, I don't like the numbers, can we, you know, tweak them a little bit? And we're probably saying across Australia there's maybe some ethics issues or everybody's come across something. Do you think there's any sort of organisations that are actively changing their risk culture? Are there any markets out there where you're seeing these sort of ethics things come to the fore and actually positive improvements being made? Or do you think it's still a bit early?
I think that the banks have been under a lot of pressure over the last 10 to 15 years, and I think that there are pockets of positive change, not just in the big four, but in some of the smaller players as well. Community banking and credit union sector is one sector that I think we can learn a lot from. There are some really outstanding people in those organisations. But I look at things as a kind of, Anthony, I'm sure it's the same, it's climbing a mountain. So how far has, say, for example, NAB come following the 2003 scandals? It's an ongoing working process. You can't change the system overnight. So I think I don't know if that's the kind of answer that you're looking for. But there are pockets of positive change in all sorts of places, and often they're hiding under rocks.
Yeah. So I guess it's more. Yeah. Are there places that we can take lessons from? I guess.
I'd look at the credit union sector as really interesting experiments going on there, because it is more organic and more localised and less centralised. So.
Thank you.
I don't know, but I know it's happening. I mean, if we didn't have a lot of people taking courageous stances in various places, we would be very much more corrupt than ICAC has identified.
Hi, I'm Heather Navid at TAL. You mentioned CBA a few times, and I'm kind of wondering whether companies are being encouraged to maybe take a different stance or give a different message because of exactly the sort of thing that's going to be on tonight, all of the negative press, so that when people are trying to actually take a virtuous or correct stance or doing a lot of work to correct past mistakes, we're still judging them for it in an ongoing basis. So do we, the public, the media readers, have a sort of ethical or moral obligation to actually kind of cut these people some slack and give them room to fix their mistakes, I guess?
I think that's a really good point, because I think that as humans, if we keep seeing the bad side, we'll just get so depressed that we take our bat and our ball and we go. And I think you're right. I guess CBA's topical because it's on TV tonight. But yeah, all of these firms are taking steps to try and move towards it. I mean, that's another tension that you hold, the tension between, you know, what might be called greenwash or sort of PR-focused things and the genuine stuff that's happening. These big organisations are like super tankers. They take a long time to turn. So I think that's a reasonable point. And certainly in our teaching, we try and have as many positive models and not just the bad guys.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, this question of reintegrative shaming means that we must be ready to forgive people and say that you know, you're better than what you've just done. I would encourage you to read the appendix to our paper, which is a little quote from John Braithwaite's book on what might have happened if the Australian regulators had given Arthur Andersen a really real workover, because they identified a partner in Arthur Andersen who was fired in Australia for doing some bad things. And he says if that was an opportunity, actually, to have got to the foundation of the Arthur Andersen culture, and if they had made the other partners and this particular partner was fired face each other and discuss questions of culture, they might well have turned the whole thing around, which is this reintegrative. You're never so bad that you have to be chucked out.
Do we have any more? Well, while you're thinking, Anthony, you said two opposing things. One thing you said was that it was an insult to suggest that management was dishonest, inherently dishonest, and then you used the expression that everybody just has rolling off their tongue all the time: keep management honest. You've also given us that wonderful word, criminogenic. And what I'd like to know is the remuneration structure, which you don't like, and I understand exactly why, is it simply unnecessary, or is it actually counterproductive? And if it's counterproductive, is it making good people evil, or is it attracting evil people into the position?
Thank you, Richard. I think one of the questions, clearly, as being human, we're entitled to contradict ourselves from time to time. And I think it would be wrong to say that management is dishonest and that we've got evil people there. We've got people that are doing things that are worse than they're capable of doing. But in terms of I do think the current system is actually not just unnecessary, but actually does harm. If you remember, at the end of the summit last year, we had three people talk about leadership. One of them was, now let me get her name, Monica Butler, who's the CEO of the City of Sydney. And the last question she was asked was, we spoke about both, the discussion was about transformation and bonuses, and two of the speakers said you needed the incentives to be correct. And, in fact, I got a tweet and a question, and right at the end was, will Monica tell us about her motivation? And I thought she came out incredibly positive about all the wonderful things that the City of Sydney is doing. And they had abolished bonuses 3 years previously because they regarded it as counterproductive. And it seemed to me very clear that the organization, her inspiration, I found her inspirational. And I think the work that they're doing on infrastructure in Sydney is pretty good.
I guess some of my research is in the field of HRM, human resource management, and there's a lot of literature to show that when you have a complex relationship between effort and performance, which is clearly the case, it's not as we've said in our paper, it's clearly not a simple relationship between the appointment of somebody and the performance of the firm, and you reward it as if it is a simple relationship, you'll often bring about lots of negative unintended consequences. So again, it's trying to use a simplistic single lever to change or to bring about positive change in a complex system.
Thank you. We should have had the 5-minute bell. I don't know if you heard it at the back. Yes, thank you. So we're on borrowed time, but we can still borrow some of that time if there are any more comments or questions. Yes? Name, please.
My name's Kevin O'Sullivan. It's more of a comment than a question. I think that my view is that you mentioned the HIH example. That's kind of the negative aspect of it. The positive aspect is your city council person. I think that the more we have that person within our society or business environment, the more that we're going to get to the best solution. So, comment.
Another person that's worth having a look for, does a great TED talk, is a guy called Ray Anderson, who died a couple of years ago. But he was a trailblazer in bringing sustainability to actually carpets, you know, the industrial commercial carpets. And this is probably one of his interfloor carpets that we're sitting on now. But he's a really inspiring, positive example of someone who brought about change and went on to inspire a lot of other people. TED Talks in general are good things to look at if you want to look for positive, inspirational examples of leadership. That's on YouTube, yeah. Good point.
Okay, any more? I can see a little bit of twitching, sort of possibly, maybe. Yes.
I enjoyed the presentation, but I did want to just challenge one of the comments that was raised, which is there was a strong degree of negativity associated with size of remuneration by Anthony earlier. And I think I know exactly where you were aiming at. In my sense, size of remuneration isn't really the key issue. This is my personal view on the matter. It's more that's a function or of a working outflow of market forces and negotiating powers of the relative parties. But the key issue is aligning remuneration with the long-term sustainable outcomes of an organisation. And the danger I see is actually short-termism, where people focus on very short-term goals. People have very short-term views as to, you know, contract might only be 3 years for key people and the like. So I just wanted to challenge that point.
Thanks, David. Research actually is not entirely clear. What is quite interesting, they've done some work on size of remuneration and differences in remuneration in the National Football League and in basketball. And under certain circumstances, you do get a negative situation where you get vast differences in remuneration. And my major concern is when the senior people are paid millions and the people reporting to them are paid hundreds of thousands, the difficulty to challenge them is the problem. So one needs to have a situation where you've got a number of strong personalities who are made equal in one way or the other.
So just so that means that middlemen should be paid more.
Short-termism is absolutely the enemy of changing systems positively.
Yeah. Well, talking about short-termism, the doors are open. And we have a short time to get to the next session. So before we do that, could you please join me in thanking Anthony and Tracy.